This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations by Ronen Bergman. Read for you by Rob Shapiro. If someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. The Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Sanhedrin, Portion 72, verse 1. Chapter 1. In Blood and Fire. On September 29, 1944, David Shomron hid in the gloom of St. George Street, not far from the Romanian church in Jerusalem. A church building was used as officers' lodgings by the British authorities governing Palestine, and Shomron was waiting for one of those officers, a man named Tom Wilkin, to leave. Wilkin was the commander of the Jewish unit at the Criminal Investigation Department, CID, of the British Mandate for Palestine, and he was very good at his job, especially the part that involved infiltrating and disrupting the fractious Jewish underground. Aggressive, yet also exceptionally patient and calculating, Wilkin spoke fluent Hebrew, and after 13 years of service in Palestine, he had an extensive network of informants. Thanks to the intelligence they provided, underground fighters were arrested, their weapons caches were seized, and their planned operations, aimed at forcing the British to leave Palestine, were foiled. Which was why Shomron was going to kill him. Shomron and his partner that night, Yaakov Banai, codenamed Mazel, Luck, were operatives with Lehi, the most radical of the Zionist underground movements fighting the British in the early 1940s. Though Lehi was the acronym for the Hebrew phrase, Fighters for the Freedom of Israel, the British considered it a terrorist organization, referring to it dismissively as the Stern Gang, after its founder, the romantic ultra-nationalist Avraham Stern. Stern and his tiny band of followers employed a targeted mayhem of assassinations and bombings, a campaign of personal terror, as Lehi's operations chief and later Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir called it. Wilkin knew he was a target. Lehi already had tried to kill him and his boss, Jeffrey Morton, nearly 3 years earlier, in its first clumsy operation. On January 20, 1942, assassins planted bombs on the roof and inside the building of 8th Yael Street in Tel Aviv. Instead, they ended up killing three police officers, two Jews and an Englishman, who arrived before Wilkin and Morton and tripped the charges. Later, Morton fled Palestine after being wounded in another attempt on his life, that one in retribution for Morton having shot Stern dead. None of those details, the back and forth of who killed whom and in what order, mattered to Shomron. The British occupied the land the Zionists saw as rightfully theirs. That was what mattered, and Shamir had issued a death sentence against Wilkin. For Shomron and his comrades, Wilkin was not a person, but rather a target, prominent and high value. "We were too busy and hungry to think about the British and their families," Shomron said decades later. After discovering that Wilkin was residing in the Romanian church annex, the assassins set out on their mission. Shomron and Banai had revolvers and hand grenades in their pockets. Additional Lehi operatives were in the vicinity, smartly dressed in suits and hats to look like Englishmen. Wilkin left the officers' lodgings in the church and headed for the CID's facility in the Russian compound, where underground suspects were held and interrogated. As always, he was wary, scanning the street as he walked and keeping one hand in his pocket all the time. As he passed the corner of St. George and Mia Sharim streets, a youngster sitting outside the neighborhood grocery store got up and dropped his hat. This was the signal, and the two assassins began walking toward Wilkin, identifying him according to the photographs they'd studied. Shomron and Banai let him pass, gripping their revolvers with sweating palms. Then they turned around and drew. Before we did it, Mazal, Banai, said, "Let me shoot first," Shomron recalled. "But when we saw him, I guess I couldn't restrain myself. I shot first." Between them, Banai and Shomron fired 14 times. 11 of those bullets hit Wilkin. "He managed to turn around and draw his pistol," Shomron said, "but then he fell face first. A spurt of blood came out of his forehead like a fountain. It was not such a pretty picture." Shomron and Banai darted back into the shadows and made off in a taxi, in which another Lehi man was waiting for them. "The only thing that hurt me was that we forgot to take the briefcase in which he had all his documents," Shomron said. "Other than that, I didn't feel anything, not even a little twinge of guilt. We believed the more coffins that reached London, the closer the day of freedom would be." The idea that the return of the people of Israel to the land of Israel could be achieved only by force was not born with Stern and his Lehi comrades. The roots of that strategy can be traced to 8 men who gathered in a stifling one-room apartment overlooking an orange grove in Jaffa on September 29, 1907, exactly 37 years before a fountain of blood spurted from Wilkin's head, when Palestine was still part of the Turkish Ottoman Empire. The flat was rented by Yitzhak Ben Zvi, a young Russian who'd immigrated to Ottoman Palestine earlier that year. Like the others in his apartment that night, all emigrants from the Russian Empire, sitting on a straw mat spread on the floor of the candlelit room, he was a committed Zionist, albeit part of a splinter sect that had once threatened to rend the movement. Zionism as a political ideology had been founded in 1896, when Viennese Jewish journalist Theodor Herzl published Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State. He had been deeply affected while covering the trial in Paris of Alfred Dreyfus, a Jewish army officer unjustly accused and convicted of treason. In his book, Herzl argued that anti-Semitism was so deeply ingrained in European culture that the Jewish people could achieve true freedom and safety only in a nation-state of their own. The Jewish elite of Western Europe, who'd managed to carve out comfortable lives for themselves, mostly rejected Herzl, but his ideas resonated with poor and working-class Jews of Eastern Europe, who suffered repeated pogroms and continual oppression, and to which some of them responded by aligning themselves with leftist uprisings. Herzl himself saw Palestine, the Jews' ancestral homeland, as the ideal location for a future Jewish state, but he maintained that any settlement there would have to be handled deliberately and delicately, through proper diplomatic channels and with international sanction, if a Jewish nation was to survive in peace. Herzl's view came to be known as political Zionism. Ben Zvi and his 7 comrades, on the other hand, were, like most other Russian Jews, practical Zionists. Rather than wait for the rest of the world to give them a home, they believed in creating one themselves, in going to Palestine, working the land, making the desert bloom. They would take what they believed to be rightfully theirs, and they would defend what they had taken. This put the practical Zionists in immediate conflict with most of the Jews already living in Palestine. As a tiny minority in an Arab land, many of them peddlers and religious scholars and functionaries under the Ottoman regime, they preferred to keep a low profile. Through subservience and compromise and bribery, these established Palestinian Jews had managed to buy themselves relative peace and a measure of security. But Ben Zvi and the other newcomers were appalled at the conditions their fellow Jews tolerated. Many were living in abject poverty and had no means of defending themselves, utterly at the mercy of the Arab majority and the venal officials of the corrupt Ottoman Empire. Arab mobs attacked and plundered Jewish settlements, rarely with any consequences. Worse, as Ben Zvi and the others saw it, those same settlements had consigned their defense to Arab guards, who in turn would sometimes collaborate with attacking mobs. Ben Zvi and his friends found this situation to be unsustainable and intolerable. Some were former members of Russian left-wing revolutionary movements inspired by the people's will, Narodnaya Volya, an aggressive anti-tsarist guerrilla movement that employed terrorist tactics, including assassinations. Disappointed by the abortive 1905 revolution in Russia, which in the end produced only minimal constitutional reforms, some of these socialist revolutionaries, social democrats, and liberals moved to Ottoman Palestine to reestablish a Jewish state. They all were desperately poor, barely scraping by, earning pennies at teaching jobs or manual labor in the fields and orange groves, often going hungry. But they were proud Zionists. If they were going to create a nation, they first had to defend themselves. So they slipped through the streets of Jaffa in pairs and alone, making their way to the secret meeting in Ben Zvi's apartment. That night, those eight people formed the first Hebrew fighting force of the modern age. They decreed that from then forward, everything would be different from the image of the weak and persecuted Jew all across the globe. Only Jews would defend Jews in Palestine. They named their fledgling army Bar Giora, after one of the leaders of the great Jewish revolt against the Roman Empire in the first century. On their banner, they paid homage to that ancient rebellion and predicted their future. "In blood and fire Judea fell," it read. "In blood and fire Judea will rise." Judea would indeed rise. Ben Zvi would one day be the Jewish nation's second president. Yet first, there would be much fire and much blood. Bar Giora was not at first a popular movement, but more Jews arrived in Palestine from Russia and Eastern Europe every year, 35,000 between 1905 and 1914, bringing with them that same determined philosophy of practical Zionism. With more like-minded Jews flooding into the Yeshuv, as the Jewish community in Palestine was called, Bar Giora in 1909 was reconstituted into the larger and more aggressive Hashomer, Hebrew for the Guard. By 1912, Hashomer was defending 14 settlements, yet it was also developing offensive, albeit clandestine, capabilities, preparing for what practical Zionists saw as an inevitable eventual war to take control of Palestine. Hashomer therefore saw itself as the nucleus for a future Jewish army and intelligence service. Mounted on their horses, Hashomer vigilantes raided a few Arab settlements to punish residents who had harmed Jews, sometimes beating them up, sometimes executing them. In one case, a special clandestine assembly of Hashomer members decided to eliminate a Bedouin policeman, Arif al-Arsan, who had assisted the Turks and tortured Jewish prisoners. He was shot dead by Hashomer in June 1916. Hashomer did not recoil from using force to assert its authority over other Jews, either. During World War I, Hashomer was violently opposed to Nili, a Jewish spy network working for the British in Ottoman Palestine. Hashomer feared that the Turks would discover the spies and wreak vengeance against the entire Jewish community. When they failed to get Nili to cease operations or to hand over a stash of gold coins they'd received from the British, they made an attempt on the life of Yosef Leshansky, one of its members, managing only to wound him. In 1920, Hashomer evolved again, now into the Haganah, Hebrew for defense. Though it was not specifically legal, the British authorities, who had been ruling the country for about 3 years, tolerated the Haganah as the paramilitary defensive arm of the Yishuv. The Histadrut, the Socialist Labor Union of the Jews in Israel that was founded in the same year, and the Jewish Agency, the Yeshuv's autonomous governing authority, established a few years later, both headed by David Ben-Gurion, maintained command over the secret organization. Ben-Gurion was born David Yosef Grun in Płońsk, Poland, in 1886. From an early age, he followed in his father's footsteps as a Zionist activist. In 1906, he migrated to Palestine and, thanks to his charisma and determination, soon became one of the leaders of the Yishuv, despite his youth. He then changed his name to Ben-Gurion, after another of the leaders of the revolt against the Romans. Haganah in its early years was influenced by the spirit and aggressive attitude of Hashomer. On May 1, 1921, an Arab mob massacred 14 Jews in an immigrant's hostel in Yaffa. After learning that an Arab police officer by the name of Tvik Bey had helped the mob get into the hostel, Haganah sent a hit squad to dispose of him, and on January 17, 1923, he was shot dead in the middle of a Tel Aviv street. As a matter of honor, he was shot from the front and not in the back, according to one of those involved. And the intention was to show the Arabs that their deeds are not forgotten and their day will come, even if belatedly. The members of Hashomer who led the Haganah at the outset were even willing to commit acts of violence against fellow Jews. Yaakov Dehan was a Dutch-born Haredi, an ultra-Orthodox Jew, living in Jerusalem in the early 1920s. He was a propagandist for the Haredi belief that only the Messiah could establish a Jewish state, that God alone would decide when to return the Jews to their ancestral homeland, and that humans trying to expedite the process were committing a grave sin. In other words, Dehan was a staunch anti-Zionist, and he was surprisingly adept at swaying international opinion. To Yitzhak Ben Zvi, by now a prominent Haganah leader, that made Dehan dangerous. So he ordered his death. On June 30, 1924, just a day before Dehan was to travel to London to ask the British government to reconsider its promise to establish a Jewish nation in Palestine, two assassins shot him three times as he emerged from a synagogue on Yaffa Road in Jerusalem. Ben-Gurion, however, took a dim view of such acts. He realized that in order to win even partial recognition from the British for Zionist aims, he would have to enforce orderly and more moderate norms on the semi-underground militia under his command. Hashomer's brave and lethal lone riders were replaced after the Dehan murder by an organized, hierarchical armed force. Ben-Gurion ordered Haganah to desist from using targeted killings. As to personal terror, Ben-Gurion's line was consistently and steadily against it. Haganah commander Yisrael Galili testified later, and he recounted a number of instances in which Ben-Gurion had refused to approve proposals for hits against individual Arabs. These included the Palestinian leader Haj Amin al-Husseini and other members of the Arab Higher Committee, and British personnel, such as a senior official in the Mandate's Lands Authority who was obstructing Jewish settlement projects. Not everyone was eager to acquiesce to Ben-Gurion. Avraham Tehomi, the man who shot Dehan, despised the moderate line Ben-Gurion took against the British and the Arabs, and, together with some other leading figures, he quit Haganah, and in 1931 formed the Irgun Zvai Leumi, the National Military Organization, whose Hebrew acronym is Etzel, usually referred to in English as IZL or the Irgun. This radical right-wing group was commanded in the 1940s by Menachem Begin, who in 1977 was to become Prime Minister of Israel. Inside the Irgun, too, there were clashes, personal and ideological. Opponents of Begin's agreement to cooperate with Britain in its war against the Nazis broke away and formed Lehi. For these men, any cooperation with Britain was anathema. These two dissident groups both advocated, to different degrees, the use of targeted killings against the Arab and British enemy, and against Jews they considered dangerous to their cause. Ben-Gurion remained adamant that targeted killings would not be used as a weapon, and even took aggressive measures against those who did not obey his orders. But then World War II ended, and everything, even the views of the obstinate Ben-Gurion, changed. During World War II, some 38,000 Jews from Palestine volunteered to help and serve in the British Army in Europe. The British formed the so-called Jewish Brigade, albeit somewhat reluctantly, and only after being pressured by the Yishuv's civilian leadership. Unsure exactly what to do with the brigade, the British first sent it to train in Egypt. It was there, in mid-1944, that its members first heard of the Nazi campaign of Jewish annihilation. When they were finally sent to Europe to fight in Italy and Austria, they witnessed the horrors of the Holocaust firsthand, and were among the first to send detailed reports to Ben-Gurion and other leaders of the Yishuv. One of those soldiers was Mordechai Gichon, who later would be one of the founders of Israeli military intelligence. Born in Berlin in 1922, Gichon had a father who was Russian and a mother who was the scion of a famous German-Jewish family, niece of Rabbi Leo Beck, a leader of Germany's liberal, reform, Jews. Gichon's family moved to Palestine in 1933, after Mordechai had been required in his German school to give the Nazi salute and sing the party anthem. He returned as a soldier to a Europe in ruins, his people nearly destroyed, their communities smoldering ruins. The Jewish people had been humiliated, trampled, murdered, he said. Now was the time to strike back, to take revenge. In my dreams when I enlisted, revenge took the form of me arresting my best friend from Germany, whose name was Detlef, the son of a police major. That's how I would restore lost Jewish honor. It was that sense of lost honor, of a people's humiliation, as much as rage at the Nazis, that drove men like Gichon. He first met the Jewish refugees in the border between Austria and Italy. The men of the brigade fed them, took off their own uniforms to clothe them against the cold, tried to draw out of them details of the atrocities they had undergone. He remembers an encounter in June 1945, in which a female refugee came up to him. She broke away from her group and spoke to me in German, he said. She said, "You, the soldiers of the brigade, are the sons of Bar Kokhba, the great hero of the Second Jewish Revolt against the Romans in AD 132 to 135. She said, "I will always remember your insignia and what you did for us." Gichon was flattered by the Bar Kokhba analogy, but for her praise and gratitude, Gichon felt only pity and shame. If the Jews in the brigade were the sons of Bar Kokhba, who were these Jews? The soldiers from the land of Israel, standing erect, tough, and strong, saw the Holocaust survivors as victims who needed help, but also as part of the European Jewry who had allowed themselves to be massacred. They embodied the cowardly, feeble stereotype of the Jews of the diaspora, the exile in traditional Jewish and Zionist parlance, who surrendered rather than fought back, who did not know how to shoot or wield a weapon. It was that image, in its most extreme version, the Jew as a Musulman, prisoner's slang for the emaciated, zombie-like inmates hovering near death in the Nazi camps, that the new Jews of the Yishuv rejected. My brain could not grasp, not then and not today, how it could have been that there were tens of thousands of Jews in a camp with only a few German guards. But they did not rise up. They simply went like lambs to the slaughter, Gichon said more than 60 years later. Why didn't they tear the Germans to shreds? I've always said that no such thing could happen in the land of Israel. Had those communities had leaders worthy of the name, the entire business would have looked completely different. In the years following the war, the Zionists of the Yishuv would prove, both to the world and, more important, to themselves, that Jews would never again go to such slaughter, and that Jewish blood would not come cheaply. The 6 million would be avenged. We thought we could not rest until we had exacted blood for blood, death for death, said Hanoch Bartov, a highly regarded Israeli novelist who enlisted in the brigade a month before his 17th birthday. Such vengeance, though, atrocity for atrocity, would violate the rules of war and likely be disastrous for the Zionist cause. Ben-Gurion, practical as always, publicly said as much. Revenge now is an act of no national value. It cannot restore life to the millions who were murdered. Still, the Haganah's leaders privately understood the need for some sort of retribution, both to satisfy the troops who had been exposed to the atrocities and also to achieve some degree of historical justice and deter future attempts to slaughter Jews. Thus, they sanctioned some types of reprisals against the Nazis and their accomplices. Immediately after the war, a secret unit, authorized and controlled by the Haganah High Command and unknown to the British commanders, was set up within the brigade. It was called Gmul, Hebrew for recompense. The unit's mission was revenge, but not a robber's revenge, as a secret memo at the time put it. Revenge against those SS men who themselves took part in the slaughter. "We looked for big fish," Mordechai Gichon said, breaking a vow of silence among the Gmul commanders that he'd kept for more than 60 years. The senior Nazis, who had managed to shed their uniforms and return to their homes. The Gmul agents worked undercover even as they performed their regular brigade duties. Gichon himself assumed two fake identities, one as a German civilian, the other as a British major, as he hunted Nazis. In expeditions under his German cover, Gichon recovered the Gestapo archives in Tarvisio, Wallach, and Klagenfurt, to which fleeing Nazis had set fire, but only a small part of which actually burned. Operating as the British major, he gleaned more names from Yugoslavian communists who were still afraid to carry out revenge attacks themselves. A few Jews in American intelligence also were willing to help by handing over information they had on escaped Nazis, which they thought the Palestinian Jews would use to better effect than the American military. Coercion worked, too. In June 1945, Gmul agents found a Polish-born German couple who lived in Tarvisio. The wife had been involved in transferring stolen Jewish property from Austria and Italy to Germany, and her husband had helped run the regional Gestapo office. The Palestinian Jewish soldiers offered them a stark choice: cooperate or die. "The goy broke and said he was willing to cooperate," said Yisrael Kalmi, who interrogated the couple and later, after Israel was born, would become the commander of the Israeli Army's military police. "I assigned him to prepare lists of all the senior officials that he knew and who had worked with the Gestapo and the SS. Name, date of birth, education, and positions." The result was a dramatic intelligence breakthrough, a list of dozens of names. Gmul's men tracked down each missing Nazi, finding some wounded in a local hospital where they were being treated under stolen aliases, and then pressured those men to provide more information. They promised each German he would not be harmed if he cooperated, so most did. Then, when they were no longer useful, Gmul agents shot them and dumped the bodies. There was no sense in leaving them alive to tip the British command to Gmul's clandestine mission. Once a particular name had been verified, the second phase began, locating the target and gathering information for the final killing mission. Gichon, who'd been born in Germany, often was assigned that job. "No one suspected me," he said. "My vocal cords were of Berlin stock. I'd go to the corner grocery store or pub or even just knock on a door to convey greetings from someone. Most of the time, the people would respond to their real names or recoil into vague silence, which was as good as a confirmation." Once the identification was confirmed, Gichon would track the Germans' movements and provide a detailed sketch of the house where he lived or the area that had been chosen for the abduction. The killers themselves worked in teams of no more than five men. When meeting their target, they generally wore British military police uniforms, and they typically told their target they had come to take a man named so-and-so for interrogation. Most of the time, the German came without objection. As one of the unit's soldiers, Shalom Giladi, related in his testimony to the Haganah archive, the Nazi was sometimes killed instantly and other times transported to some remote spot before being killed. "In time, we developed quiet, rapid, and efficient methods of taking care of the SS men who fell into our hands," he said. As anyone who has ever gotten into a pickup truck knows, a person hoisting himself up into one braces his foot on the rear running board, leans forward under the canvas canopy, and sort of rolls in. The man lying in wait inside the truck would take advantage of this natural tilt of the body. The minute the German's head protruded into the gloom, the ambusher would bend over him and wrap his arms under his chin, around his throat, in a kind of reverse chokehold, and carrying that into a throttle embrace, the ambusher would fall back flat on the mattress, which absorbed every sound. The backward fall, while gripping the German's head, would suffocate the German and break his neck instantly. One day, a female SS officer escaped from an English detention camp next to our base. After the British discovered that the officer had escaped, they sent out photographs of her taken during her imprisonment, front and side view, to all the military police stations. We went through the refugee camp and identified her. When we addressed her in German, she played the fool and said she only knew Hungarian. That wasn't a problem. A Hungarian kid went up to her and said, "A ship carrying illegal immigrants from Hungary is about to sail for Palestine. Pack up your belongings quietly and come with us." She had no choice but to take the bait and went with us in the truck. During this operation, I sat with Zaro, Mayor Zorea, later an IDF general, in the back, while Carmi drove. The order Carmi gave us was, "When I get some distance to a suitable deserted place, I'll honk the horn. That will be the sign to get rid of her." That's what happened. Her last scream in German was, "Was ist los?" What's going on? To make sure she was dead, Carmi shot her, and we gave her body and the surroundings the appearance of a violent rape. In most cases, we brought the Nazis to a small line of fortifications in the mountains. There were fortified caves there, abandoned. Most of those facing their executions would lose their Nazi arrogance when they heard that we were Jews. "Have mercy on my wife and children." We would ask him how many such screams the Nazis had heard in the extermination camps from their Jewish victims. The operation lasted only 3 months, from May to July, during which time Gemul killed somewhere between 100 and 200 people. Several historians who've researched Gemul's operations maintain that the methods used to identify targets were insufficient, and that many innocents were killed. On many occasions, those critics argue, Gemul teams were exploited by their sources to carry out personal vendettas. In other cases, operatives simply identified the wrong person. Gemul was closed down when the British, who had heard complaints about disappearances from German families, grasped what was going on. They decided not to investigate further, but to transfer the Jewish brigade to Belgium and the Netherlands, away from the Germans, and Haganah Command issued a firm order to cease revenge operations. The brigade's new priorities, according to the Haganah, not the British, were to look after Holocaust survivors, to help organize the immigration of refugees to Palestine in the face of British opposition, and to appropriate weapons for the Yishuv. Yet, though they ordered Gemul to stop killing Germans in Europe, the Haganah's leaders did not forsake retribution. The vengeance that had been halted in Europe, they decided, would be carried on in Palestine itself. Members of the German Tempelgesellschaft, the Templar sect, had been expelled from Palestine by the British at the beginning of the war because of their nationality and Nazi sympathies. Many joined the German war effort and took an active part in the persecution and annihilation of the Jews. When the war ended, some of them returned to their former homes in Sarona, in the heart of Tel Aviv, and other locations. The leader of the Templars in Palestine was a man named Gotthilf Wagner, a wealthy industrialist who assisted the Wehrmacht and the Gestapo during the war. A Holocaust survivor by the name of Shalom Friedman, who was posing as a Hungarian priest, related that in 1944 he met Wagner, who boasted that he was at Auschwitz and Buchenwald twice. When he was in Auschwitz, they brought out a large group of Jews, the youngest ones, and poured flammable liquid over them. "I asked them if they knew there was a hell on earth, and when they ignited them, I told them that this was the fate awaiting their brethren in Palestine." After the war, Wagner organized the attempts to allow the Templars to return to Palestine. Rafi Eitan, the son of Jewish pioneers from Russia, was 17 at the time. Here come exultant Germans, who had been members of the Nazi Party, who enlisted to the Wehrmacht and SS, and they want to return to their property when all the Jewish property outside was destroyed, he said. Eitan was a member of a 17-man force from the Haganah's special company, sent to liquidate Wagner, under a direct order from the Haganah High Command. The Haganah Chief of Staff, Yitzhak Sadeh, realized that this was not a regular military operation, and summoned the two men who had been selected to squeeze the trigger. To encourage them, he told them about a man he had shot with his pistol in Russia, as revenge for a pogrom. On March 22, 1946, after painstaking intelligence gathering, the hit squad lay in wait for Wagner in Tel Aviv. They forced him off the road onto a sandy lot at 123 Levinsky Street and shot him. Haganah's underground radio station, Kol Yisrael, the Voice of Israel, announced the following day, the well-known Nazi Gotthilf Wagner, head of the German community in Palestine, was executed yesterday by the Hebrew underground. Let it be known that no Nazi will place a foot on the soil of the land of Israel. Shortly thereafter, Haganah assassinated two other Templars in the Galilee and two more in Haifa, where the sect had also established communities. It had an immediate effect, Eitan said. The Templars disappeared from the country, leaving everything behind, and were never seen again. The Templars' neighborhood in Tel Aviv, Sarona, would become the headquarters of Israel's armed forces and intelligence services, and Eitan, an assassin at 17, would help found the Mossad's targeted killing unit. The killing of the Templars was not merely a continuation of the acts of revenge against the Nazis in Europe, but signified a major change in policy. The lessons that the new Jews of Palestine learned from the Holocaust were that the Jewish people would always be under the threat of destruction, that others could not be relied upon to protect the Jews, and that the only way to do so was to have an independent state. A people living with this sense of perpetual danger of annihilation is going to take any and all measures, however extreme, to obtain security, and will relate to international laws and norms in a marginal manner, if at all. From now on, Ben-Gurion and the Haganah would adopt targeted killings, guerrilla warfare, and terrorist attacks as additional tools, above and beyond the propaganda and political measures that had always been used, in the effort to achieve the goal of a state and to preserve it. What had only a few years before been a means used only by the outcast extremists of Lehi and the Irgun was now seen by the mainstream as a viable weapon. At first, Haganah units began assassinating Arabs who had murdered Jewish civilians. Then the militia's high command ordered a special company to begin personal terror operations, a term used at the time for the targeted killings of officers of the British CID who had persecuted the Jewish underground and acted against the Jewish immigration to the land of Israel. They were ordered to blow up British intelligence centers that acted against Jewish acquisition of weapons and to take retaliatory action in cases where British military courts sentenced Haganah members to death. Ben-Gurion foresaw that a Jewish state would soon be established in Palestine, and that the new nation would immediately be forced to fight a war against Arabs in Palestine and repel invasions by the armies of neighboring Arab states. The Haganah command thus also began secretly preparing for this all-out war, and as part of the preparations, an order code named Zarzir, or Starling, was issued, providing for the assassination of the heads of the Arab population of Palestine. While the Haganah slowly stepped up the use of targeted killings, the radical undergrounds had their killing campaign in full motion, trying to push the British out of Palestine. Yitzhak Shamir, now in command of Lehi, resolved not only to eliminate key figures of the British mandate locally, killing CID personnel and making numerous attempts to do the same to the Jerusalem police chief, Michael Joseph McConnell, and the High Commissioner, Sir Harold McMichael, but also Englishmen in other countries who posed a threat to his political objective. Walter Edward Guinness, more formally known as Lord Moyne, for example, was the British resident Minister of State in Cairo, which was also under British rule. The Jews in Palestine considered Moyne a flagrant anti-Semite, who had assiduously used his position to restrict the yeshuva's power by significantly reducing immigration quotas for Holocaust survivors. Shamir ordered Moyne killed. He sent two Lehi operatives, Eliyahu Hakim and Eliyahu Betzuri, to Cairo, where they waited at the door to Moyne's house. When Moyne pulled up his secretary in the car with him, Hakim and Betzuri sprinted to the car. One of them shoved a pistol through the window, aimed it at Moyne's head, and fired three times. Moyne gripped his throat. "Oh, they've shot us," he cried, and then slumped forward in his seat. Still, it was an amateurish operation. Shamir had counseled his young killers to arrange to escape in a car, but instead they fled on slow-moving bicycles. Egyptian police quickly apprehended them, and Hakim and Betzuri were tried, convicted, and, 6 months later, hanged. The assassination had a decisive effect on British officials, though not the one Shamir had envisioned. As Israel would learn repeatedly in future years, it is very hard to predict how history will proceed after someone is shot in the head. After the unmitigated evil of the Holocaust, the attempted extermination of an entire people in Europe, there was growing sympathy in the West for the Zionist cause. According to some accounts, up until the first week of November 1944, Britain's Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, had been pushing his cabinet to support the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. He rallied several influential figures to back the initiative, including Lord Moyne. It is not a stretch to assume, then, that Churchill might well have arrived at the Yalta summit with Franklin Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin with a clear, positive policy regarding the future of a Jewish state, had Lehi not intervened. Instead, after the Cairo killing, Churchill labeled the attackers a new group of gangsters and announced that he was reconsidering his position. And the killing continued. On July 22, 1946, members of Menachem Begin's Irgun planted 350-kilogram explosives in the south wing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, where the British Mandate's administration and army and intelligence offices were housed. A warning call from the Irgun apparently was dismissed as a hoax. The building was not evacuated before a massive explosion ripped through it. 91 people were killed and 45 wounded. This was not the targeted killing of a despised British official or a guerrilla attack on a police station. Instead, it was plainly an act of terror, aimed at a target with numerous civilians inside. Most damningly, many Jews were among the casualties. The King David Hotel bombing sparked a fierce dispute in the yeshuv. Ben-Gurion immediately denounced the Irgun and called it an enemy of the Jewish people. But the extremists were not deterred. 3 months after the King David attack, on October 31, a Lehi cell, again acting on their own without Ben-Gurion's approval or knowledge, bombed the British embassy in Rome. The embassy building was severely damaged, but thanks to the fact that the operation took place at night, only a security guard and two Italian pedestrians were injured. Almost immediately after that, Lehi mailed letter bombs to every senior British cabinet member in London. On one level, this effort was a spectacular failure. Not a single letter exploded. But on another, Lehi had made its point, and its reach, clear. The files of MI5, Britain's security service, showed that Zionist terrorism was considered the most serious threat to British national security at the time, even more serious than the Soviet Union. Irgun cells in Britain were established, according to one MI5 memo, to beat the dog in its own kennel. British intelligence sources warned of a wave of attacks on selected VIPs, among them Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin and even Prime Minister Clement Attlee himself. At the end of 1947, a report to the British High Commissioner tallied the casualties of the previous 2 years. 176 British Mandate personnel and civilians killed. Only these actions, these executions, caused the British to leave, David Shomron said, decades after he shot Tom Wilkin dead on a Jerusalem street. If Avraham Stern had not begun the war, the State of Israel would not have come into being. One may argue with these statements. The shrinking British Empire ceded control of the majority of its colonies, including many countries where terror tactics had not been employed due to economic reasons and increased demands for independence from the native populations. India, for instance, gained its independence right around the same time. Nevertheless, Shomron and his ilk were firmly convinced that their own bravery and their extreme methods had brought about the departure of the British. And it was the men who fought that bloody underground war, guerrillas, assassins, terrorists, who would play a central role in the building of the new state of Israel's armed forces and intelligence community. Chapter 2. A Secret World is Born. On November 29, 1947, the United Nations General Assembly voted to divide Palestine, carving out a sovereign Jewish homeland. The partition wouldn't go into effect until 6 months later, but Arab attacks began the very next day. Hassan Salameh, the commander of the Palestinian forces in the southern part of the country, and his fighters ambushed two Israeli buses near the town of Petah Tikva, murdering 8 passengers and injuring many others. Civil war between Palestinian Arabs and Jews had begun. The day after the bus attacks, Salameh stood in the central square of the Arab port city of Jaffa. "Palestine will turn into a bloodbath," he promised his countrymen. He kept that promise. During the next 2 weeks, 48 Jews were killed and 155 wounded. Salameh, who led a force of 500 guerrillas and even directly attacked Tel Aviv, became a hero in the Arab world, lionized in the press. The Egyptian magazine Al-Musawar published an enormous photograph of Salameh briefing his forces in its January 12, 1948 issue. Under the banner headline, "The Hero Hassan Salameh, Commander of the Southern Front." Ben-Gurion had prepared for such assaults. To his thinking, Palestine's Arabs were the enemy, and the British, who would continue to rule until the partition took formal effect in May 1948, were their abettors. The Jews could depend only on themselves and their rudimentary defenses. Most of the Haganah troops were poorly trained and poorly equipped, their arms hidden in secret caches to avoid confiscation by the British. They were men and women who had served in the British Army, bolstered by new immigrants who had survived the Holocaust, some of them Red Army veterans, but they were vastly outnumbered by the combined forces of the Arab states. Ben-Gurion was aware of the estimations of the CIA and other intelligence services that the Jews would collapse under Arab attack. Some of his own people weren't confident of victory, but Ben-Gurion, at least outwardly, displayed confidence in the Haganah's ability to win. To bridge the numerical gap, the Haganah's plan then was to use selective force, picking targets for maximum effectiveness. As part of this conception, a month into the Civil War, its high command launched Operation Starling, which named 23 leaders of the Palestinian Arabs who were to be targeted. The mission, according to Haganah's commander-in-chief, Yaakov Dori, was threefold: elimination or capture of the leaders of the Arab political parties, strikes against political centers, strikes against Arab economic and manufacturing centers. Hassan Salameh was at the top of the list of targets. Under the leadership of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and spiritual leader of the Palestinian Arabs, Salameh had helped lead the Arab Revolt of 1936, in which Arab guerrillas for 3 years attacked both British and Jewish targets. Both al-Husseini and Salameh fled Palestine after they were put on the British Mandate's Most Wanted list. In 1942, they joined forces with the SS and the Abwehr, the Nazis' military intelligence agency, to plot Operation Atlas. It was a grandiose plan in which German and Arab commandos would parachute into Palestine and poison Tel Aviv's water supply in order to kill as many Jews as possible, rousing the country's Arabs to fight a holy war against the British occupiers. It failed miserably when the British, having cracked the Nazis' Enigma code, captured Salama and four others after they dropped into a desert ravine near Jericho on October 6, 1944. After World War II, the British released al-Husseini and Salami. The Jewish agency's political department, which oversaw much of the Yishuv's covert activity in Europe, tried to locate the former and kill him several times between 1945 and 1948. The motive was partly revenge for the Mufti's alliance with Hitler, but it was also defensive. Al-Husseini might have been out of the country, but he was still actively involved in organizing attacks on Jewish settlements in northern Palestine and in attempts to assassinate Jewish leaders. Due to a lack of intelligence and trained operational personnel, all those attempts failed. The hunt for Salame, the first Haganah operation to integrate human and electronic intelligence, began promisingly. A unit belonging to Shai, the Haganah's intelligence branch, and commanded by Isser Harel, tapped into the central telephone trunk line that connected Jaffa with the rest of the country. Harel had a tool shed built on the grounds of the nearby Mikveh Israel Agricultural School and filled it with pruning shears and lawnmowers. But hidden in a pit under the floor was a listening device clipped to the copper wires of Jaffa's phone system. I'll never forget the face of the Arabic-speaking Shai operative who put on a set of headphones and listened to the first conversation, Harel later wrote in his memoir. His mouth gaped in astonishment, and he waved his hand emotionally to silence the others who were tensely waiting. The lines were bursting with conversations that political leaders and the chiefs of armed contingents were conducting with their colleagues. One of the speakers was Salame. In one of the intercepted calls, Shai learned he would be traveling to Jaffa. Haganah agents planned to ambush him by felling a tree to block the road on which his car would be traveling. But the ambush failed, and it was not the last failure. Salame survived multiple assassination attempts before falling in combat in June 1948, his killer unaware of his identity. Almost all of the other Operation Starling targeted killing bids also failed because of faulty intelligence or flawed performances by the unskilled and inexperienced hitmen. The only operations that did succeed were all carried out by two of the Haganah's elite units, both of which belonged to the Palmach, the militia's only well-trained and fairly well-armed corps. One of these units was the Palyam, the Marine Company, and the other was the Arab Platoon, a clandestine commando unit whose members operated disguised as Arabs. Palyam, the naval company, was ordered to take over the port in Haifa, Palestine's most important maritime gateway, as soon as the British departed. Its task was to steal as much of the weaponry and equipment the British were beginning to ship out as possible, and to prevent the Arabs from doing likewise. We focused on the Arab arms acquirers in Haifa and the north. We searched for them and killed them, recalled Avraham Dar, one of the Palyam men. Dar, who was a native English speaker, and two other Palyam men posed as British soldiers wanting to sell stolen gear to the Palestinians for a large amount of cash. A rendezvous was set up for the exchange near an abandoned flour mill on the outskirts of an Arab village. The three Jews, wearing British uniforms, were at the meeting place when the Palestinians arrived. Four others who were hiding nearby waited for the signal and then fell upon the Arabs, killing them with metal pipes. We feared that gunshots would wake the neighbors, and we decided on a silent operation, said Dar. The Arab platoon was established when the Haganah decided it needed a nucleus of trained fighters who could operate deep inside enemy lines, gathering information and carrying out sabotage and targeted killing missions. The training of its men, most of them immigrants from Arab lands, included commando tactics and explosives, but also intensive study of Islam and Arab customs. They were nicknamed Misaravim, the name by which Jewish communities went in some Arab countries, where they practiced the Jewish religion, but were similar to the Arabs in all other respects, dress, language, social customs, etc. Cooperation between the two units produced an attempt on the life of Sheikh Nimr al-Khatib, a head of the Islamic Organizations of Palestine, one of the original targets of Operation Starling, because of his considerable influence over the Palestinian street. The Mistaravim could move around without being stopped by either the British or the Arabs. In February 1948, they ambushed al-Khatib when he returned from a trip to Damascus with a carload of ammunition. He was badly wounded, left Palestine, and removed himself from any active political roles. A few days later, Avraham Dar heard from one of his port worker informants that a group of Arabs in a cafe had been talking about their plan to detonate a vehicle packed with explosives in a crowded Jewish section of Haifa. The British ambulance that they had acquired for this purpose was being readied in a garage in Nazareth Road, in the Arab part of the city. The Mistaravim prepared a bomb of their own in a truck that they drove into the Arab district, posing as workers engaged in fixing a burst pipe, and parked next to the wall of the garage. "What are you doing here? No parking here. Move the truck!" the men in the garage yelled at them in Arabic. "Right away, we're just getting a drink and we need to take a leak," the Mistaravim replied in Arabic, adding a few juicy curses. They walked away to a waiting car, and minutes later their bomb went off, detonating the one in the ambulance as well, and killing the five Palestinians working on it. On May 14, 1948, Ben-Gurion declared the establishment of the new state of Israel and became its first prime minister and minister of defense. He knew what to expect next. Years earlier, Ben-Gurion had ordered the formation of a deep network of sources in the Arab countries. Now, 3 days before the establishment of Israel, Reuven Shiloah, director of the political department of the Jewish Agency, the agency's intelligence division, had informed him that the Arab states have decided finally to launch a simultaneous attack on May 15. They are relying on the lack of heavy armaments and a Hebrew air force. Shiloah provided many details about the attack plan. The information was accurate. At midnight, after the state was declared, seven armies attacked. They far outnumbered and were infinitely better equipped than the Jewish forces, and they achieved significant gains early on, conquering settlements and inflicting casualties. The Secretary General of the Arab League, Abdul Rahman Azam Pasha, declared, "This will be a war of great destruction and slaughter that will be remembered like the massacres carried out by the Mongols and the Crusaders." But the Jews, now officially Israelis, rapidly regrouped and even went on the offensive. After a month, a truce was mediated by the United Nations Special Envoy, Count Folk Bernadotte. Both sides were exhausted and in need of rest and resupply. When fighting resumed, the tables were turned and, with excellent intelligence and battle management, along with the help of many Holocaust survivors who had only just arrived from Europe, the Israelis drove the Arab forces back and eventually conquered far more territory than had been allocated to the Jewish state in the UN partition plan. Though Israel had repelled superior armies, Ben-Gurion was not sanguine about the embryonic Israel Defense Force's short-term victory. The Arabs might have lost the first battles, but they, both those who lived in Palestine and those in the Arab states surrounding Israel, refused to accept the legitimacy of the new nation. They vowed to destroy Israel and return the refugees to their homes. Ben-Gurion knew the IDF couldn't hope to defend Israel's long, convoluted borders through sheer manpower. From the remnants of the Haganah's shy intelligence operations, he had to begin building a proper espionage system fit for a legitimate state.